Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the news and politics editor at Crosscut. President Donald Trump has made immigration a cornerstone of his political agenda. And his rhetoric, while inflaming his critics and galvanizing his base, doesn't always contain all the facts. That makes it difficult for journalists who are attempting to report accurately on everything from migrant caravans to family separation. And for advocates and activists, there's a new urgency to counter the administration's narrative. Crosscut brought a few of those perspectives together to talk about the president's rhetoric and his administration's approach to immigration policy. Sarah Stillman is a staff writer at The New Yorker and director of the Global Migration Project at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. She's received a number of awards for her work, including the National Magazine Award. She was named a MacArthur Fellow in 2016. Maru Mora Villapando is a community organizer and undocumented immigrant. She's been an outspoken activist for many years and currently leads Northwest Detention Center Resistance, which advocates for detainees at the detention center in Tacoma, Washington, and against detention and deportation. Jorge Barone is the executive director of the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project, a nonprofit legal services organization that defends the rights of low-income immigrants. He is originally from Bogota, Colombia, and immigrated to the U.S. at the age of 13. Aura Bogado is an investigative reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Her work focuses on immigration and, in particular, on children. She most recently broke the story of systemic abuse in migrant children's shelters nationwide. Crosscut staff reporter Lily Fowler moderated the discussion. This conversation is sponsored by Comcast and Waldron. It was recorded on May 4th, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
Thanks for coming out on such a beautiful day. I wanted to start by, we've got four really interesting people on our panel, and I'd just like each of them to introduce themselves and tell us more about themselves and why they became interested in immigration issues in the first place. So, Maru, you wanna start?
Yeah. Buenas tardes. My name is Maru Mora Villalpando. I'm an undocumented immigrant. Single mother, and I've lived in the U.S. for over 20 years now. And I became interested because when my visa expired, I kept asking immigration lawyers, how do I get to adjust my status? And everybody kept saying, wait for immigration reform, wait for immigration reform. So I got involved in that, and I realized that was a mistake. So I jumped on the direct action wagon, and now we together created NWDC Resistance, which, by the way, is called now La Resistencia, just to make it easier for everybody. And we are a group that support people detained in the Northwest Detention Center to shut down the detention center itself.
Hey, everyone. I'm Aura Bogado. I'm an investigative reporter at Reveal. And I got interested in immigration, particularly in reporting about immigration, because I think growing up an immigrant myself and seeing what a lot of people in my own community were going through, I didn't always see that reflected in the English language press as much as it usually is in the Spanish language press. And so I wanted to, you know, see if I could write about this stuff and also include the perspectives of the people who are most affected by the policies that we write about.
Hi, I'm Sarah Stillman. I'm a staff writer with The New Yorker magazine, and I run the Global Migration Project at Columbia Journalism School. And I actually started out thinking I was going to be a conflict correspondent, and I was a freshman in college when the Iraq War began, and I flew off to Iraq to cover the war, but I came from a labor union household, and the very first thing I noticed when I landed on the largest U.S. military base in Baghdad was this large number of immigrant workers who have been shipped in from all around the world, 70,000 people, many of whom have been trafficked to do a lot of the difficult jobs on the bases, many of whom were sexually assaulted with impunity. So the very first piece I ever wrote for The New Yorker was actually supposed to be a war story, but wound up being a migration story. And then I started covering criminal justice and thought I was going to be covering mostly just prisons and jails and the justice system, and found increasingly this convergence with the immigration system, as the fellow panelists know really well. So it just keeps coming into any other theme I've tried to tackle. So I decided, why not go whole hog?
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Jorge Barón, and I think the reason that I do this work now is because I came to the United States when I was 13 from Colombia. At the time I didn't speak English, and while my path to be able to get legal status had a much easier path to come, as I look back now, especially as an immigration attorney, to look back at how easy my path was. But at the time, as a 13-year-old and being a cranky teenager, I experienced it much more differently, and felt very isolated during that time. But the one thing that I, looking back during that time, was all the people who were kind and thoughtful and who helped me during those years. And so, particularly at these times when there's so many attacks, I feel a responsibility to try to do some of the same things that people did to help me when I was 13. And also just the experience of navigating. I mean, my path was so much easier, but I remember going to my green card interview with my family when I was young, and going to this, INS office, and just the weight of this decision that was going to be made by this bureaucracy. And even though I was, still relatively young, just understanding how weighty this decision was. So that, is definitely part of what drives the work that I do now.
Great, thank you. So as the name of the panel suggests, I want to talk about the Trump administration in relation to lies. And I wanted to hear from the panelists about how they've navigated some of the misinformation that's coming from the administration right now, in particular in relation to family separation. Auda, I know you've reported a lot on that. I think you even had a couple stories where you compared the experiences of people to what the government was saying. You've also had a series of stories revealing some of what the government has done to children, at the migrant centers, and sexual abuse, drugs were involved. You had a story about that. And I know, Sarah, you've also written about family separation in a more narrative way. And obviously, Maru, you're involved in the discussion as an activist. And Jorge, from the legal perspective, you know a lot about the subject as well. So if we could go down, perhaps, and just talk about some of the misinformation that you've encountered, how you've navigated it, and we'll go from there.
For us, family separation has occurred for many, many, many decades now. This is not new. But it obviously has gotten worse in the past 2 years. And when it was known last year of the zero tolerance policy, and people were asking, where are the children? We also kept saying, where are the parents? What we've seen at the detention center here in Tacoma is that really the experiment began with adults. How many things can we do to adults in detention that then at some point we're going to reproduce with children? But think about every time you see an adult being detained, that also creates the separation of their family. We also emphasize the fact of there's a lot of single people in detention, so not everybody has a child. But for us, the family separation means just the fact of an individual being detained. The lies that we've seen, obviously, are so many. Where to start? But I can tell you that the very first time we saw, we witnessed the organizing of people detained in the first largest hunger strike on March 7 of 2014, where we actually were able to meet with ICE. We crashed a meeting. We didn't get invited.
But the way they respond to our requests for negotiations was, these people are in the best detention center in the nation. So ICE always talks about NWDC as the best detention center, the top detention center. And every time something happens and we showcase, right, maggots in the food, people being sent to solitary confinement as retaliation for their organizing, being paid $1 a day, and sometimes not even that, for all the work that is the backbone of the detention center. Pregnant women, people in wheelchairs, and you name it, so many things that have happened. And you still say this is the top detention center, so just imagine how the other ones are. So I think that not only what we've seen in the detention center, but also people that are in the partition proceedings like myself, we keep finding lies after lies of what ICE is doing. And so for us, family separation means that it does impact everybody in the community, but how it impacts each of our members of our communities is horrible. Now to think, if again, they've done this to adults, we cannot even imagine how this has impacted children.
So if the question is about misinformation in this administration, I know we only have 40 minutes, and I want to hear from the other panelists as well. But I mean, it's something that I think every reporter comes up against, really in any administration, but I think markedly so in this administration. And the way I personally approach that is, I love digging into public records, so whether that's court records or, FOIA records, soliciting the government for its own records on a variety of things. But I also personally, like in my work, I really, as much as possible, like whenever I can, try to find someone who's been affected again by those policies. So it's sort of, if we kind of triangulate it, it might be the administration, what the record says, which often counters that, and then in this case, in the case of the Shiloh Treatment Center, for example, right, here's a residential treatment center that's, you know, contracted by the federal government to hold children that have been deemed to have some kind of challenge in which a regular shelter couldn't provide for their care. And there have been a lot of allegations in court records about forced drugging. And the record shows that, but I became very intent on like trying to find a child who had been there. Wound up finding a lot of kids, talked to more than half a dozen kids who had been there. And then, you know, one family did decide to go on the record and kind of explain from their perspective, what had happened. And it's interesting to, you know, have family separation blow up. I'd already been following that story for a while and trying to find a family who might be comfortable, you know, sharing what happened, because it's heavy, right? It's trauma, and you're asking people, like, please relive that trauma for an audience that you may not even connect with in English, right? It's interesting that the child that I interviewed and, you know, spent time with, the family, he was 9 when he came here. His mom had already been here, right? So Maribel had already been here, kind of like gone through the system. She escaped a harrowing situation back home in Honduras. And she wanted her son back, and so he came. He came with another, with a cousin. And he experienced that separation in a way that wasn't as a result of zero tolerance, per se, but he had been separated, right, from his mom, and all he wanted to do was get back. He tried to run away from the shelter that he was at, and then that and some other behavior landed him in this residential treatment center where he was forcibly drugged, right? Like, his mom pleaded with them. I saw texts, I saw, you know, a lot of evidence on her end where she was like, please, please stop drugging him. Like, he can't even talk. He's gained a lot of weight. He looks lethargic. And, it was a really big fight to get him out. And so it's interesting that there is so much of a focus on family separations, but I think to echo what you were saying earlier, you know, yes, it happened under zero tolerance, but the way that certain families we tend to say immigrant families, right? But like in a lot of cases, we're talking about refugees. I think that's also something really important to remember. There are a lot of ways that families get separated.
I like what you said about finding an individual person that people can connect to as readers, because I think one of the starting places for me is always thinking about where do you find that intersection between a compelling and viscerally kind of emotional individual story, but also connecting that individual story to something systemic, something structural. And to me, kind of one of the many fundamental lies at the heart of the zero tolerance prosecutions was this idea that these people had done a criminal act by virtue of crossing not at a port of entry. And Kristen Nielsen consistently kept making this point at all of her public press appearances, saying, well, why don't they appear at a valid port of entry? So one of the very first things I thought about doing, and a lot of reporters started doing, is just the shoe leather work of going to the ports of entry, going to the other side of the border, and finding many people who had come here as asylum seekers and actively been turned away at a port of entry or given a number and said, hey, why don't you wait in Reynosa, a very, very dangerous city where they were routinely being subject to kidnappings, to extortion, to all kinds of violence, replicating the very violence they had just fled in a traumatic circumstance. And so to be able to directly juxtapose the rhetoric of the administration about why are they not crossing at legal ports of entry to the concrete stories of people who had done exactly that and then faced concrete harm as a result felt valuable as a starting point. And so I've thought a lot about how would we also, as journalists and as investigative journalists in particular, try to create our own data where data doesn't exist? Because you've been such an expert at using FOIA, using public records to tell stories. But part of what's hard is that a lot of the stories that feel valuable to tell right now, there are no documents that either they're going to make available or even that exist in the first place. So the largest investigative project I've worked on for the past few years, which started under the Obama administration but has felt particularly urgent under family separations and under Trump, has been trying to document the cases of people who were deported and then killed or harmed after their deportation, especially asylum seekers, and in some cases asylum seekers who had been prosecuted under zero tolerance and sent back without their children only to face further harm. So I've worked with a team to essentially create a database, kind of one by one, putting together those cases, and disturbingly, we now have 127 of those. And the last thing I'll say really quickly in regard to family separation is that we've also been so lucky to have the work of activists and litigators unearthing documents. So one other story that comes to mind is a piece I wrote about a girl named Helen who had been separated from her grandmother as a five-year-old after Trump had officially ended the separations. So I think what we get from people who are doing this work on the ground is, again, a chance to compare the rhetoric, like, okay, we've officially ended separations as a policy, with empirically what we're seeing on the ground. And in this case, the five-year-old, after she was separated from her grandmother, after the end of these separations, was actually made to sign paperwork giving up her right to see a judge, a five-year-old who had entered her little five-year-old signature next to this Flores bond hearing agreement, which I can guarantee you, I didn't know what a Flores bond hearing paperwork was, so I'm pretty sure this five-year-old did not.
So I think the first thing I want to say is I want to echo what Maru said about the fact that, you know, separations have been happening for so long. One of I started working at Northwestern Arrest Project in 2006. One of my very first cases was a woman from Guatemala who had been living here. She's a single mom, and she was arrested in a traffic accident. Somebody actually rear-ended her, so she was kind of like the, you know, victim in this case of having been rear-ended by this other vehicle. And the police came and found out that she had a deportation order. This was in Kirkland, and she had just come from dropping off her 7-year-old daughter at school that morning. You know, she was, you know, separated from her kid for many months while we were fighting her case. And so, and there were, of course, like thousands of stories like that well before the Trump administration and many, many during the Obama administration. So I just want to make sure that people think that, you know, family separation has either ended or was only happening during Trump. Like, the family separation as a part of the immigration system, particularly with immigration detention, has been happening for many years. I think what's happened with the Trump administration is that, of course, they've kind of weaponized it and made it a sort of an intentional tactic to deter people. But but you know, we're seeing it in other contexts. So you know, right now, the last few weeks, we've had a lot of people, Border Patrol, for example, right here in our state, going after people who go into the courthouses in Grant County and Adams County in Eastern Washington. And we have cases where it's, you know, a mother of three U.S. citizen children who are now left separated. So I think it's just important to note that those separations are happening all the time, and we need to not lose sight of that. The other thing that in terms of the misinformation, I completely agree with the points that we were made earlier too, especially about the issue of this excuse of the fact that, like, well, people are getting put through the criminal justice system, because during that time, we had clients, the people who were transferred to the federal detention center, for example, where the parents actually, I represented one of the mothers who had never actually been criminally prosecuted, right? And she was still separated, right? So it was a complete, lie. And of course, even the people who did get prosecuted, the judges in the southern border would usually just sentence them to time served, and then they were back in the immigration system, right? So there's no reason that they should have been separated from their kids at all. So all of that was just, a cover to try to hide the fact that they were doing this, intentionally to try to, deter families from coming and fleeing the situations that we've heard about.
Great. Well, thank you. As a follow-up question, I wanted to ask, and this is kind of a question I want to ask selfishly as a reporter, although Maru and Jorge feel free to jump in as people who often talk to the press and read the news. You know, our job is to get at the truth, right? And so we're comparing notes and trying to figure out what the truth is. But at the same time, as journalists, we have to be fair and we have to be balanced. And so one criticism I often face as an immigration reporter is that I'm not being balanced enough, right? And as a reporter who's a human being, there are certain stories that I've worked on where it's hard to see the other side. For example, a son being ripped from her mother, like you were talking about, Oda. Wondering how do you navigate that question, that follow up with, okay, so maybe you are getting at the truth, but are you being fair to the other side at the same time?
I wish people in the administration would talk to me more. I mean, I feel like I give them ample opportunity. I don't like to ambush somebody the day before we're about to publish and say, here's my list of questions, call me or it's out. We try to give people time and plenty of time, and then, follow up on what they said and then come back. That's part of the luxury of doing investigative is to, if it takes a year, it takes a year. If a spokesperson needs another week to get back to me and I believe that they're saying that in good faith, absolutely. That they can definitely have that week. I haven't been very successful in, really getting people on or off the record. I mean, I do have some great off-the-record sources, but for the most part, I mean, even spokespeople themselves, it has to be Jennifer Alzea, for example, from ICE. It might be very difficult. For me, at least, it has been to like hear from her when I have just a common question. When it is to the level of like some of our reporting last year, we found there was a private ICE contractor that was holding children who'd just been taken from their parents in a vacant office building in Phoenix. Right? Then we get a response because I think it becomes a little bit of a PR nightmare, right? To have video of private contractors, right? Like just taking all these kids into this empty building, right? And I would like to know more. And I do ask questions. And so if the question to me is like, why wasn't it more balanced? I mean, I do really in good faith. I want to hear, what the administration or in that case in particular, also the private contractor, what was going on. And to be fair, that private contractor MVM. They've been around for quite a long time, and they are donors to the more democratic side of the aisle, right? I think that's the best way that I can be fair is to really give people time, and I don't, you know, I wouldn't do otherwise.
Yeah, I think our stories are always more rich and more nuanced and more engaging to readers when we are pursuing, as thoroughly as possible, fairness. And I think fairness does entail talking to all the parties involved in a case when possible. And at The New Yorker, we do have a policy of what we call no surprises journalism. So we have a fact-checking department, which is increasingly a dying species in most of the industry. But The New Yorker has invested very heavily in the fact-checkers, literally to the point that I once said in an article that a young woman sat down on her tan suede couch, and the fact-checker learned that it was actually not suede, it was a microfiber that resembled suede. So that's the level that we go to value getting the nitty-gritty right, because the more bulletproof the story is, the more we're able to meaningfully rebut the actual lies of this administration or prior administrations or people within some of the industries that are profiting from some of this. So, and I also learn a lot as a reporter when I try to talk to multiple sides, because sometimes you go in there thinking the story is one thing, and not sometimes, actually most of the time, if you're genuinely rigorous and honest about listening receptively, you will learn that the story is more complicated than it was when you began, and it's almost always the better for it.
So related to that, I wanted to ask each of you, where do you come down on using the word lie with in reference to the administration? I mean, this panel is called, you know, has that word in it, right? But even the, you know, reporters at the New York Times have talked about this and about how, why they've shied away from using that word with reference to Trump in specific. Any thoughts about that, any of you?
Well, we actually came up with a hashtag last year of hashtag ice lies. So I wish it had picked up, but it didn't. I don't know what else to call it, right? If I say something that is not the truth, I'm going to be called out on it. The ICE is going to say, you lied, and therefore, you know, you're going to get deported or whatever. I think that sometimes reporters do step back and are afraid of pushing the envelope. For example, we have in the past been able to invite reporters to talk directly with people detained. In the past 2 years, that's been impossible. That's not the case anymore. So we know journalists, real journalists, need to do a lot of work, and we want them to do it. So we want them to have access to the detention center, to have access to people detained. But if there's no access, then we also are told, well, prove it. But why isn't it on us? And I think there's been proof after proof of the lies that this administration has done. I was sharing an example about my Tuesday court. I was there waiting, and there was this young boy that was also in deportation proceedings, and it turns out that the paperwork was wrong. The paperwork that the judge had was for a girl, and this was a boy. And everybody just turned out, look at each other, and the judge kind of got all nervous, and then everybody's like, well, that's the asylum office. The asylum office made a mistake, and I just turned to my daughter and say, and that's how children get lost, right? So we just witnessed how that happens. And why is it that people are afraid to use a terminology that is very accurate to what we're seeing? I really don't understand, because I think the standard for us as activists is really, really high. But why isn't it that high also for the administration then?
Wondering if the journalists have any different thoughts or Jorge?
I mean, in terms of the word lie, I can't remember like having used it in the last year per se. But I think that the stories that we tend to publish and work on, I know a lot of times I just try to present, here is what we've found, and then you can draw your own conclusion, right? I don't think that the word lie is inappropriate. But, you know, it depends who's saying what at which time. And I think that, I don't necessarily shy away from it. I just also I don't want to say, you know, for sure I've used it in the last, you know, X months or years or anything like that.
Well, you know, I think the challenge that I see is that the precedent lies. I mean, I think that's so clear. But it's become so prevalent now that it's just, it's almost like it's non-use, right? I mean, I think that's the problem is that we got to the point where it's just so pervasive that like people don't even pay attention. And I think it is filtering down, you know, because part of what I sense is now that the people in the departments are, you know, hearing what's from the top, the way they're articulating, the way that the president is referring to people who are seeking asylum, and that's having a real effect in further dehumanizing. And I'm not saying the things were great before, but I think it's making the problem so bad in terms of poor treatment. And we just see, you know, following on what Maru said about ICE lice, I mean, Border Patrol, for example, is like one of the worst agencies about that. I mean, there's this great little piece that somebody found of a report they wrote about, the report is supposed to be an interview that apparently the Border Patrol agent wrote about a three-year-old that they were interviewing, right? First of all, it's a little suspect that they were interviewing this three-year-old. But then, you know, so if you follow it, there's a question where it said, like, well, what were you coming to do in the United States? And the three-year-old apparently answers, I'm coming to work in Houston. That's what the agent wrote in the report and certified under penalty of perjury, right? And so, you know, and this is so common because it's what they do, and they sort of copy and paste, right, the same thing. And this agent just didn't even think about the fact that, like, he probably shouldn't put that section in the report referring to a three-year-old. But, you know, and that seems like, you know, it's laughable, but the problem is that kind of cut and paste, when we go to immigration court and represent an asylum seeker and we go and present their asylum case, and then the attorney for the government then shows the report and says, look, they told the Border Patrol agent they're coming to work in Houston, right? And so the judge is like, well, that's an inconsistent statement, and so I'm going to find you not credible, and so you lose your asylum case, right? And so those lies are, you know, not having like a real effect, and that they're depriving people who should be getting an opportunity for protection, a lack of protection. And I think that's just, you know, going to be even more, because if your boss is doing it repeatedly, you know, then why is it a problem? And they're not having any consequences happen. You know, why would I not do it in my job? Especially when he's telling me that, you know, all these people are like bad, evil people that are coming to, like, you know, murder Americans. So I think that's the way that this is infecting, you know, the whole system, in it worse than it was before.
What grade would you give the media in general with regard to fact checking the administration? Are there big stories right now within the field of immigration that you think reporters are missing? And I think about this myself, because, for example, you mentioned we've been talking a lot about family separation, right? And I even catch myself writing that the administration ended the zero tolerance policy, and then you hear stories about kids still being separated from their families, right? And Auda, you mentioned how you've been putting on this for a while now. I mean, this isn't something new necessarily. It's being used in a different way than it was in the past. But do you think the media in general is doing, is able to keep up with what we're getting from the administration as far as the misinformation? And are there any big stories that you can think of that haven't really caught on?
You know, I was talking to a behavioral science scientist recently, and she was talking about research she's done on debunking lies and how, paradoxically, the more and more fact-checking you do to say X thing is false, don't believe it, the more you reinscribe that very idea in people's minds, and the more they believe it oftentimes. And I think that's one of the really difficult quandaries of reporting in this particular era, is that you can spend an enormous amount of resources and use up all of your investigative energy chasing down ways to debunk certain lies, and then you miss other critical stories or fall prey to certain types of overly simplified dichotomies. Like, I would argue that one of the big ones that a lot of us have fallen prey to as reporters is creating these clear lines between, like, the deserving immigrants and the undeserving immigrants. Like, for instance, I know a line that Obama often used in trying to explain his immigration reforms was to say, well, we're going to privilege families, not felons. And one of the things that I've often found in reporting is that that's not a very simple line. Like, I remember going and interviewing a young woman who is incarcerated in Oklahoma. She'd come here as a sex trafficking victim as a child, and she'd, as a result of all that trauma, developed an addiction. And she'd wound up in a juvenile facility where she'd had a tantrum and spat on a guard. And it turns out that in Oklahoma, not only is this a felony, but you can actually be prosecuted as a child for this felony as an adult. So she actually was criminally prosecuted as an adult, and then when she reached her 18th birthday and was pregnant, she was deported to a country where the only people she knew were her traffickers, and so she went back to them. And so it made me really think about how could we tell stories like that in a way that doesn't fall into those easy binaries of the worthy and the unworthy. And I think another big story, and you've done some wonderful reporting on this, is just looking at all the different forms of profiteering in the immigration enforcement landscape. So I mentioned earlier that I have been doing a lot of criminal justice reporting as well, and have noted the convergence of those systems. And one of the things I've found is that right now, I think there's a really healthy conversation going on in our country around mass incarceration, and a real recognition that mass incarceration is not serving us particularly well. And I think that a lot of the private prison companies saw the writing on the wall quite some time ago and moved a lot of energy and resources into the immigration detention context. And I think we're currently seeing the ramifications of some of that. And I think that's a really critical story that will be playing out for quite some time.
I think that I'm both excited that there are so many reporters on this beat now, and also concerned. It's like at the same time, because you know, you talk about immigration court, people think it's like a regular court, and it's not, right? It's like a court within the enforcement system, right? Like your right to appeal, like things that you assume and like know about court from just like civics doesn't apply here. And I think even, I know I've read stuff in the last year where I'm like, I don't know that this reporter necessarily knows that. And it, you know, don't, it's hard to blame people because, you know, they're reporters and they're new on this beat. But in terms of like, even like how accurate we can all be, right? Like it's, there's always like, I feel like, and I don't, I'd love to get a sense from you, like on this beat, there's always like this term illegal. Illegal, illegally, illegal immigrant, can't, you know, crossed illegal. There's like such a focus on that. And even like what that word does, and like for accuracy's sake, I mean, I read it all the time where like, this child crossed illegally. And first of all, the act of crossing without authorization is a federal misdemeanor. It's very rarely tried. You're very rarely charged with it. Most of the families that I know that were separated, you know, as others have mentioned, were not charged under that, but most of the adults. And as far as I know, a child has never been charged under for that. I don't even know that like a child can be charged for a federal misdemeanor. So like, what are we doing when it comes to like even like these assumptions? How does that get through like from the reporter to the editor to the copy to, you know, and then to the reader, right? And it's like we're automatically attaching this illegality to a child that is seeking refuge oftentimes from horrors that like are even hard to imagine, right? So it's both. I mean, there is, I know, like in my own newsroom, you know, we have three people that work on immigration, and I just feel like there's just stacks. You know, people share things, people want to talk, people know that something is wrong, and it's just trying to figure out, like, okay, how do we divide all this work? And again, like, it's exciting on one hand because there are stories everywhere, stories here, everywhere. But the way that they're approached and the assumptions that we carry as reporters and as newsrooms in general and media in general is also concerning.
I wanted to talk now briefly about social media and its role in getting to the truth, right? I was a reporter in St. Louis at one point during Ferguson, and social media played a big role in that. And I know that a lot of the activists in the area felt that was the only way the truth was really going to come out, was by them tweeting what was happening themselves, right? They couldn't rely on the paper of record. And then now, under this administration, social media is playing a big role again, right? And Auda, I noticed that you tweet a lot, and you're pretty outspoken on Twitter. Sarah, I looked at your Twitter profile quickly and you have like zero tweets, right? So two very different approaches, right? And I'm sure Maru is an activist. You're active on social media. I see your post on Facebook sometimes. So I'm wondering if you guys could talk about, do you think social media is helping get at the truth? Is it something in between? Is it harming things overall? What do you think?
I like Twitter because I found it useful at a time when, like, as a woman of color, it's hard to like claim space in public. So as an individual, I really liked it. I do, you know, use it as a reporter. And, you know, sometimes it's funny. I think I tweeted like a couple days ago, we now have 19,000 Democrats running for president in 2020, because that's just like what it seems like, and it's funny. I don't think anybody would take it seriously, although you never know. And then, yeah, I mean, I just tweet out all kinds of things that are interesting to me. I think that, you know, there's always been this, or for a while, there's been this question of like objectivity. I don't think objectivity exists in terms of reporting. You know, you can be, we've talked about like being fair, and that's something that I hold near and dear. But I do have opinions about things, and I tweet them. But you know, in the context of what I'm doing, I try to be responsible. I used to be very sloppy about it. I think I made mistakes and learned from them.
Well, for us as activists and volunteers, social media is critical. We do get our messages that way. Most people even ask us, when are your meetings? And we're like, we don't have meetings. You can either find what we're doing in the social media and just come down to the detention center where we meet. But we find ourselves sometimes dealing with a lot of, obviously, lies in social media. And there's no way we can, you know, engage into debates with what we've seen in social media. And I think that social media sometimes is people follow really, really scandalous things. And that's not the way we want to create our work, right? Our social media is for education, so people know what's going on. There's so many things happening on immigration every single day. That's really how we use it, is to educate people, but also in hopes that people will take actions. Now, I saw a post the other day that says, imagine tomorrow they delete Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and boom, you're not an activist anymore. That's why we want people to read our posts and then come to the detention center and not rely on social media to believe they're activists.
I really like what you just said about this quandary regarding sensationalism, because one thing I do kind of wonder about a lot and feel very conflicted about is that I think we know empirically at this point that all of these algorithms that sort of generate the social media that we're consuming are algorithms that privilege virality and that privilege, as a result, sensationalism and things that, in a sense, kind of reaffirm our pre-existing biases and make us feel outraged. And so I've had a weird experience this past year with a story that I already mentioned, or two stories. I mentioned that I'd done this long investigative piece about deportations to harm that I spent about a year of my life on. And then in a matter of perhaps a week, I wrote that shorter piece I mentioned about the 5-year-old girl who signed away her legal rights at the border. And what I found is that it was the piece that had a somewhat, to be honest, like clickbaity title, that was like 5-year-old girl made to sign away her legal rights at the border, that generated a certain kind of virality because it clicked in people's brains immediately. They could feel outraged about it. They could see the picture of this adorable Helen and they could click on it and circulate it. And I honestly felt, on the one hand, very gratified that it, in some of these cases, you can individually highlight a case and then pretty instantaneously people get fired up and you can create concrete change and maybe even get a kid returned to their parent. On the other hand, I felt both really uncomfortable with the idea of cannibalizing the most traumatic moments in other people's lives and converting them into a tweet or into a headline, and also just conflicted about the ways in which that can then privilege chasing from one crazy sensationalized story to the next and not understanding the deeper forces informing all of this. And then I guess the last thing I would say as a positive is that as a reporter, I've been really amazed at some of the things that the sort of democratizing aspect of people being able to tell their own stories on Twitter have led to. Like, for instance, I just found a Twitter feed of a group of Indonesians who are detained, and I guess they must have cell phones, and they're tweeting about their hunger strikes from Indonesia and reaching me in my apartment in New York. And that to me feels like a really miraculous thing.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, it's a mixed bag for some of the reasons that we've talked about. But I was going to say earlier, and particularly to the earlier questions too, of part of the challenge, and I think part of the thing with social media is that it's, you know, it's short and like, you know, quick outrage thing. And I feel like part of what's missing, and Lily, to your question of like, what are the things that are not being discussed, I feel like with the perhaps the exception of Aura and Sarah, not enough is being done to connect sort of the larger issue of like race affecting, you know, the immigration system, like what, like the whole conversation around how race has infected immigration for so long. So now I was talking about the illegality, and that's like how we frame the debate right now. And like for so long we've prayed, and then we have this like romantic vision of immigration where we talk as a country, we talk about, you know, a nation of immigrants, although that's been taken out of the USCIS website now under the Trump administration. But, you know, we had this very romantic vision of like, you know, the past. But, you know, a lot of people don't know, and I think, Mario, you were talking about this earlier, that, you know, the, you know, our immigration laws, you know, from 1790, the Naturalization Act, you know, talked about, you know, to be a citizen, you have to be a free white person, right? And the word white was in the naturalization statutes all the way to 1952, right? And which is within a lifetime. And so the history of immigration has been incredibly racialized, that even more recently, the changes that we think of now, you know, of course, Trump talks about like, you know, quote unquote, chain migration and all the harms about that. And he's referring to the family reunification provisions that were put in place in 1965. And the irony is that even though they did have changes in who was able to come, when it was being debated, it was actually seen as a way to keep the population the same, because it was assumed that the people who would be able to bring their family would be the people who were already in the country. And so that they actually made it so that to make sure that the population did not change, and they just miscalculated, and it turned out that it actually led to more people of color being able to come to the United States. And so I think, you know, that's the piece that I don't think we really talk about, like the in-depth looking at the history and trying to frame how we've created immigration laws that are deeply, I could go on for a long time talking about sort of the disproportionality of who gets to come legally. I'm very conscious of that. You know, my family's able to come legally because we had resources, and generally people of color around the world are much more less likely to be able to come here with a visa, and that means that they're just going to be much less likely to be able to get status if they get here. So there's all these things that I don't think people appreciate, and so they're easily just like, well, but what part of illegal do you understand? Like, that's the thing that people focus on, and they don't understand how those institutions and that legal framework is so racialized and has been for so long, and there's things that happen in the immigration system that, you know, would not be you know, would not happen in any other context because of race so pervades in the immigration system. And that's the piece that I feel like, you know, is missing from a lot of the coverage that I see.
Okay, we are running out of time here before I take audience questions. So just quickly though, I wanted to ask you about the 2020 campaign that's already underway, and how big of an issue you think immigration is going to play. Is it going to be the issue that folks talk about throughout the campaign? Is there anything in particular within immigration that you think is going to be key to the upcoming election? Is it going to continue to be the talk about the border and the folks who are showing up there? And do you see any key candidates that stand out at you as really grasping the issue well?
Who wants this one?
I'll keep it really quick. Trump grasps this issue really well, and I do think that he's very good at motivating his base around this issue of illegality and the border, and this idea that people of darker skin children are coming to invade the country. I think he probably grasps it the best, I think, in terms of talking points, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think we're going to be hearing about caravans. Like, you know, I mean, and that's like he's now used that word, and he just, you know, and the ironic thing is that the whole caravan notion, you know, he's promoting it so much that like now people in Central America like had not heard about the caravan, but they like now they're like there's a caravan because like Trump is tweeting about it, and it is just again this idea of like, you know, race, right? It's like this idea like to get people in a lot of the country to think that there's this danger, these dangerous brown people are coming, and that motivates him. And he's, you know, I think he's understood that, and politically it's worked for him. And so I am worried, and frankly, I'm a little worried about how Democrats are going to react to that, because I think part of the challenge is that, you know, sometimes the debate is not about, you know, it's not like we have a debate about whether we should be more welcoming. It's like, is it a wall or is it a bunch of Border Patrol agents? Like, you know, is it a smart wall or a physical wall? And so if that's going to be what the debate is, then that just seems like we're, you know, profoundly disappointing.
Okay, related to that, one of my questions here is Trump and the right keep accusing immigrant supporters of backing open borders. What is the best way to articulate a humane policy to counter this charge?
Actually, I was thinking about my answer, and my answer to the first one and to this one is Democrats always try to look as tough as Republicans. And so every time that policy is a bill is introduced on immigration, they always start with border security, number one. That's their main goal, right? Border security. And when they talk about open borders, they're trying to polarize us and to make it look like if we open the borders, that's really bad. I don't see anything wrong with that. I advocate for no borders. That's what we want to see. We're an abolitionist movement and we don't want to see any borders. The reality is the only human policy is that there's no detentions and deportations, period. That there's no dignity in detention. There's a bill that was reintroduced that is called dignity in detention. Sorry, there's no dignity in detention, period, right? Cages are not for human beings, period. And so if we want to make sure that Democrats are the opposite of what Trump is doing, like right now a lot of people are running not only for president but other positions, if they really want to seem anti-Trump, they should start getting away from border security and remember that the technological surveillance that they're planning or it's already invested in the border is happening inland too. We are all being surveilled anyways. We know the contracts that Amazon has with ICE. We know that Google does. We know that Microsoft does. So in reality, the surveillance that we immigrants are facing, it's happening to all of us. So it's time to push the Democrats to actually be anti-Trump, not to look anti-Trump.
Okay, another audience member wants to know about the important immigration cases at the U.S. Supreme Court and the status of those cases. They asked specifically about the census and DACA.
Well, you know, the DACA situation is kind of an interesting one because what happened, as most people may know, the Trump administration tried to terminate DACA, and then now three different federal judges have said you can't. And the interesting thing is that the judges didn't say like you can't do it. It's just that, like the way you try to do it was illegal because you basically said, you know, that President Obama didn't have the authority to do this and it was an illegal act and that's the reason you gave. You didn't say, you know, this is just, you know, a policy I don't like and I want to change it. So they try to, you know, say it this way. And so that's what the courts have said. It's not that you can't do it ever. It's just that the way you did it was wrong. And so those have been appealed now. And the administration tried to bring it up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has actually been sitting on the cases. So they're still pending before the Supreme Court to this day for several months now. You know, I think you can sort of analyze or try to, you know, figure out what the justices are thinking. But they may just like not want to deal with it. But they haven't made a decision either way about whether to take the cases or not. So right now it's kind of at a standstill in that people are continuing, people who've had DACA in the past can continue to renew, but people who may qualify but never applied cannot. And so they're still in limbo. And of course, some people are being, you know, deported anyway who could have applied for the DACA program but didn't. And so that's still happening. With regard to the citizenship question on the census, I mean, there was the arguments a couple of weeks ago, oral arguments, and I think, you know, most observers thought that the administration has five votes to allow them to include the citizenship question. So while it's hard to predict reliably because of oral arguments, I think the expectation that people have is that the administration is going to get the justices to give them the go-ahead to include the citizenship question when they rule sometime in June, we think.
Right, okay. Another question that we have, this is kind of interesting because I actually personally have been surprised that there's even a discussion surrounding this, but the question for Michael is abolishing ICE the way forward? If so, why is that better than reform? What does just border enforcement look like? And I say that because I never even thought, I mean, abolishing ICE seems, I think, to at least at one point to a lot of people like an unrealistic goal. But it does seem like something that folks are talking more about. And if not that, then what would be, as Michael put it, a just way to enforce the border? And I think, Maru, you would say there is no just way, but anybody have?
Well, you know, when we, in 2014, we were asking Obama to do a second DACA, and he came with the executive order of DACA and DAPA. We started using dismantle ICE as the follow-up, right? We say, okay, for now we can protect certain people. And then we also were asking for a moratorium on deportations. And then we were looking at dismantling the agency altogether. Look, reform is out of the question. How many times have been Democrats in power and they never got to it, right? And even if you think of reform, actually, and you know this, Jorge, there's been reforms all the times. Like every year, there's something in regards to immigration, but it's not going our way, it goes their way. And every time I worked, and remember I said at the beginning, I worked on immigration reform for many years, and I learned how we, our communities, and our tragedies are being used for political gains. The only way to solve this nightmare right now is to dismantle, abolishing the entire agency, and shutting down every single detention center and allowing every person that has been separated to go back to their families. And there should be reparations for absolutely every person that has gone through this tragedy in detention centers, in family detention centers. This is outrageous that we're in 2019 and we continue allowing for this, and expansion of detention continues. Just this week, ICE is asking for more money. They already got billions, I can't remember how many billions already, and they're asking for more just again, right, for continuing expansion of detention. So there's no reform that will help us because it's being used against our communities to profit out of our misery. And the only solution should be to dismantle the agency that precisely it's been around for 16 years, the detention center this month, opened 15 years ago. And I think that 15 years of the detention centers are too many.
I think it's also important that we disaggregate the two questions embedded within that, because I think often these conversations get conflated. ICE, thinking about interior enforcement, which is often directed at people who may have very deep roots here, and then the separate question of what's happening at the border. I think you raised a really good point earlier in terms of the conversation that's happened around border security. Which I think we very rarely have had a conversation around some of the consequences of border militarization. And I would argue one of those, which I've seen firsthand, is watching the way it has empowered criminal organizations directly at the border, groups like the Zetas, who have now commandeered a lot of the migration routes because they know it's incredibly profitable. The harder and harder and harder we've made it to cross, the more organized crime has taken over those smuggling routes, sometimes turning them into trafficking routes, and essentially holding people in stash houses, extorting their families for ransom. And I think it's important that we recognize that that's one of the potential consequences of border militarization, because in the past, some people could come here if they wanted to work for a period of time and go back, whereas now a lot of people do tend to stay. And I think if we don't actually articulate an affirmative vision also of what we want our immigration policies to look like, then we're going to continue to have this level of total disarray in the political discourse. I think that might be a really nice starting point as well to think about how do we actually articulate an affirmative vision of what we want. And the last thing I'll say on that affirmative vision is returning to where did these protection agreements of protection come from in the first place? Well, a lot of our concept of the refugee as a legal construct kind of emerged out of the post-World War II context where the U.S. actually did revisit a central moral mistake that we made as a country, which was to have boatloads of people who had fled Nazi persecution and who had fled potential death, who had come here seeking legal refuge, and who were directly turned away, and who were sent back, and who were killed in the Holocaust. And I think as a world, we collectively got together and said, we never want to see that happen to people again. And now that's exactly what we're doing, turning people back to be harmed.
So I think that for me, you know, this is a anybody who approaches this issue from a human rights perspective is going to say, you know, deportation is just wrong, right? Because and we struggle with any aspect of immigration law because immigration law by and I say this as an immigration lawyer that I struggle with this idea all the time because the whole concept of immigration law is in making the category who's in and who's out. Essentially, that's all it is. It's like figure out who gets to stay under this legal system and who doesn't. And it's interesting because I was reflecting out. You talked earlier about the refugee versus immigrant, and I struggle with that too because like the this concept, right? Like the idea of like, oh well, if you're a refugee, you get to stay. But you know, our and a lot of people don't realize how the protections are much narrower than people most people expect because most people think like, well, if I'm going to be sent back to a country to a place where I'm going to get killed, I will get protection, right? That's not true. It depends on the reason that that you're going to face harm, right? If it's your political opinion, then you might get protection. But if it's because you are, you know, fleeing climate change in Guatemala because you can't make a living there, that's not protected under current law, right? You're not a refugee under the legal definition of that. And so, so that's, you know, a huge challenge. Like, why do we privilege one over the other? And so I think that tension is there. And until we sort of address that, I mean, until we, you know, in the long term, when people ask me, you know, what is it like the long term, you know, solution? It's not a reform of our immigration system. It's how do we promote a world where people are not forced to migrate for the reasons that they have to. It has to be, and it's just much more complicated. And this is what I was talking about, social media. Like, you can't solve it with a social media tweet, right? It's about, you know, gender-based violence that is so prevalent in some places. It's about climate change. It's about all the reasons that people right now are having to migrate in so many places in the world. And so I know it seems overwhelming, but I think it's just the honest answer is to say that we have to look at all of those issues in order to address that. Otherwise, you know, it's not ultimately going to be the ultimate solution unless we're making, you know, the fact that people should be safe, not dependent on where it happened to be born. So I think we need to focus on those issues because if somebody is not safe, it is human nature to go somewhere where they're going to be able to keep their families safe. And so we can't avoid that. We need to make sure that people are able to be safe wherever they live.
Right. Thank you, everybody, for coming.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Victoria Ralph and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the Crosscut Festival was recorded by Seattle University. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And for the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. And just a reminder to save the date for the next Crosscut Festival, May 1st and 2nd, 2020. We're still looking for suggestions on what to talk about and who to invite. To learn more, go to crosscut.com/festival. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.